Parshat Noso has many topics discussed in the early sections. Of course, it's famous for the lengthy Korbanos HaNesiyim, which we'll get to in Mitzvah Hashem. But there is actually one or two psukim, which we find in the beginning of Perek Hay, where perhaps in terms of the Parsha they don't occupy a central place, and yet in Halacha, as we'll see, they are most central. And that is in Perek Hay, if we begin with Pasuk Hay, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor, Daber B'nei Yisrael, Isha Isha, man or woman, Ki Ya'asu Mikol Chatos Ha'odom, Lim Ol Ma'al B'Hashem. Now the Pasuk describes them doing something, some sin, and the Chazal explain that the reference is to stealing, and they deny it originally, but then in Pasuk Zayin Vehisvadu Es Chatasam Asher Asuf, they subsequently come to admit that they did indeed steal. There are special halachos, he has to pay him back, plus add a fifth, and even bring a korban. This is the one of those korban osham. Okay. Now, if we look at again at the words at the beginning of Pasuk Zayin, v'hisvadu es chatasam asher asu. So we should note that there's quite a difference between how we would read them in terms of parshanut and how the halacha takes them. In terms of, and both exist side by side, as we'll see. In terms of the parshanut, these words, v'hisvadu, are yet part of the story. That is to say, they're yet part of the Torah's description of the episode before it prescribes what should happen. In our words, to summarize, originally he stole and denied it, and even took a shvuah to that effect. Subsequently, if he admits it, this is now what he should do. So the mitzvah part begins with the next phrase, Ve'eshives Hashem Oberosho, to pay back the money. These words, Ve'hisvadu Es Chatasam, are yet telling us the story, the episode. That's in terms of the Pshuto Shel Mikra. However, for various reasons, the Chazal in the Safra explain that these words, Ve'hisvadu, are themselves a separate mitzvah, a mitzvah asay from the Torah, and that mitzvah is vidu. Namely, although it's somewhat early seasonally, as we know, when it comes to tshuva, if there is a season for tshuva, there are certain pillars of tshuva, and one of them is vidui. And the source for vidui, for confession, as part of the tshuva process in the Torah, the halachic tshuva process, is from these words, v'hisvadu es chatasam. So we see it's a very striking example of Medrash Halacha lifting a phrase, so to speak, from its context in Parshanut, and seeing this not merely as a description of the situation, but as a proscription of the Torah. This is a mitzvah. And the Rambam, surely enough, codifies this in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, Mitzvah Saseh, Ayin Gimel, positive Mitzvah 73. And similarly, it is with these words that the Rambam opens Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph, Kol Mitzvah Sheba Torah, Kol HaMitzvah Sheba Torah, all mitzvahs, Bein Asei, Bein Lo Tasei, whether positive or negative, Im Avar Adam Alechad Mehem, if a person transgressed one of them, Bein Bezodon, Bein Bishkoga, whether it was intentionally, unintentionally, Kesheyaseh Tshuva, when he does Tshuva, V'yoshev Mecheto, and repents from his sin, Chayav lehivados lefnei hakel baruch hu. He is obligated to say vidui shene'emar, and Rambam quotes our pasuk. Isho isha kiyasu mikol chatos ha'odom v'hisvadu es chatosam asher asu. Bamidbar perikei psukim vav and zayin, says Rambam, ze vidui devarim. So the mitzvah of vidui is in a somewhat unlikely location, tucked there in the beginning of Parshas Noso, amongst all sorts of other things. It's not in what's called the Parsha of Tshuva, which is at the end of Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Nitzavim. Interestingly, it is stated within the context of a specific Aveira, Gezel, even though, as we know, as Rambam says, the mitzvah of tshuva and vidui is for all mitzvahs, not only for gezel. So in a sense, how did it come to find its home in the Aveira of Gezel specifically? Well, the Sfasemes has a classic comment there, and that is, says Sfasemes, from a certain point of view, every Aveira is a form of Gezel, is a form of stealing, because a person has been given their life and their faculties to do the right thing, not to do the wrong thing. If they take that energy and they use it for the wrong thing, well, that's misappropriating a God-given gift. Every Aveira is a form of Gezel. And indeed, if we move forward to the end of Yom Kippur, we again make special reference to Gezel. For we say in Ne'ilah, in those additional sections of Ne'ilah, Hashem gave us the possibility of tshuva, lema'an nechdal me'oshek yadeinu, in order that we may stay our hand from injustice, from stealing. Oshek is a form of stealing. And once again, Mefarshim explain that every type of Aveira ultimately is this aspect of stealing. What's interesting is, if we note the phraseology of the Rambam, we will see that he doesn't seem to rate tshuva itself as a mitzvah. Rather, the mitzvah is to say vidui. For again, his words are, any Aveira that a person's done, whether it's intentional or unintentional, kishe ya'ase tshuva, when he does tshuva. He doesn't say he has to do tshuva. Of course he does, but the way the Rambam describes it, when he does tshuva, v'yashuv mecheto, chayav lehisvados. He's obligated to say vidui. So there is no chayav lasos tshuva. There's only when he does tshuva, chayav lehisvados. And that is a point of much discussion amongst Mefarshim. Why is it that the Rambam doesn't seem to rate tshuva itself as a mitzvah, but rather what seems to be a component within tshuva? That's the mitzvah. That's the chiyuv. Well, the Meshechacha in Parshas Vayelech says something very interesting. The process that we call tshuva is, of course, an obligation for one who needs to avail himself of it, but it's not a new obligation. It's not a distinct obligation. Because when you think about it, here's a person, I mean, what is repenting? What is tshuva? He betters his ways. He was doing the wrong thing. He needs to do the right thing. Well, that's true, says Meshech Chochma. But the source of a person who's doing the wrong thing to then do the right thing is the very same source for everyone to do the right thing. It's the right thing. It's those mitzvahs. That means that as true as it is that this person, shall we say, has not been eating kosher or keeping Shabbos or whatever until now, and or he strayed and now he comes back, the source of his obligation to keep Shabbos now or keep kosher isn't the mitzvah of tshuva, it's the mitzvah of keeping Shabbos and eating kosher. The very same mitzvah that obligates a person who's always been doing the right thing to continue doing the right thing obligates a person who, for whatever reason, has not been doing the right thing to begin to do the right thing. So, in a sense, as much as we refer to the process of tshuva, there is no new mitzvah. The only thing that really comes in as a chiddush here is vidui. Because after all, doing the right thing doesn't necessarily involve saying vidui over the wrong thing. That's why this is the only element of tshuva that catches the designation of a distinct and independent mitzvah aseh. So this is the classic discussion with regards to tshuva, and what we do see clearly from the Rambam is that it is critical to tshuva. It's an obligation, and the person does not receive kapara until he says vidui. So it's not merely something that accompanies tshuva, it is part and parcel of the tshuva process. And in fact, it's worthwhile mentioning that this is the source of a classic question with regards to a very interesting statement in the Gemara in Maseches Kiddushin on Daf Mem Tes. Kiddushin is a legal transaction at heart, and like legal transactions, it can have conditions attached to it, subject to both agreeing to it. And the Gemara and the Mishnah will therefore go through all sorts of conditions. He is Mekadesh, this woman, on condition that such and such, that he will give her a certain amount of money, that she'll give him a certain amount of money, that he's rich, that he's not rich. Everyone has their preference. And then the Gemara says, what if, and I wonder if this has ever happened, he gives this woman the ring or the money and says, Haret Mekudesh Esli, on condition that I'm a Tzadik Gomor. I'm a completely righteous person. Well, there's nothing like advertising. So, the Gemara says, well, the condition could be has been fulfilled, except what if we know that this person is actually a Rasha? I mean, it's quite well known. Of course, we don't like to judge, but we don't have to judge because we know. So what about that? Says the Gemara, even if he was until this point known to be a Rasha, the Kiddushin are still valid. Shema, hear her, tshuva, believer, because Bikapsi, he decided to do tshuva. You never know. And therefore, it could very well be that he did fulfill the condition. Time will tell, I guess, but certainly it cannot be discounted. And all Mefarshim ask a simple question. It may well be, and let's give him the benefit of the doubt, that he had thoughts of tshuva. That's all well and good. It is good, but it's not enough. Did we not just say that critical and indispensable to the tshuva process is vidui? He may have had thoughts of tshuva in his heart, he hasn't said vidui. It's an interesting shaila. Whatever happened to the vidui? A rabbi who performs a chuppah kiddushin has to be prepared for anything. Well, the Minchas Chinuch raises this question in Simon Shin Samach Dalet, and he says something very interesting. When we talk about tshuva, tshuva does two things. Number one, it changes the status of a person from Rasha to Tzaddik, in very plain terms. It changes the status. And number two, it gives him kapara for his averus. Now, says Minchas Chinuch, those two do not happen with the same input. They are not one in the same. That is to say, when we say that vidui is an indispensable part of tshuva, that means if a person wishes to get kapara for his averos, he's got to do vidui. Without that, there's no kapara. That's where the Rambam said it's indispensable. However, in order to change his status from that of Rasha to Tzaddik, that can be done even without vidui. Generally speaking, the two go together. A Rasha has averos and a Tzaddik doesn't. However, it's possible to split them up, whereby his sincere thoughts of tshuva can change him now to be a tzaddik. He has a problem that he has a tzaddik who has a number of averus. He will yet need to treat them, and in order to do so, he'll need to say vidui. He can do that during Sheva Brachos. But in terms of the question, is he a tzaddik gomor, thoughts of tshuva enough or alone? That is a very interesting and major statement with regard from the Minchas Chinuch with regards to tshuva. I would mention that there are one or two further classic responses to this very well-known question. Once again, how can we say he's a tzaddik? He hasn't said vidui, doesn't want need vidui. Well, Rabbi Tzalo Zolti Zatzal, the Rav Rashi of Yerushalayim, he actually gives a very disarmingly simple answer. Namely, when we say that if this person said, on condition that I'm a tzaddik, perhaps he had thoughts of tshuva, and therefore the Kiddushin should be valid, we're not saying now. The Gemara never said, maybe he had thoughts of tshuva now. But rather, if this is his condition, so perhaps he had thoughts of tshuva prior to this, and indeed did tshuva, including vidui, which he needs to do, if that's the case. In other words, the premise behind the question was, we think it's all happening now. His first thoughts of tshuva is when he makes this condition, and therefore we didn't see enough tshuva. No, perhaps this is an indication of the fact that he has done tshuva prior to this moment, with whatever tshuva entails, if it requires vidui, including vidui. So it's a very simple response to this question from Rabbi Tzalo Zolti. An altogether different type of answer is brought in the name of the Kotzker Rebbe. It's not often that the Kotzker Rebbe gets involved in the halachas, but as you can see, or in terms of what we have from him, that the Kotzker Rebbe says something quite different. Should you ask, how can this person say that he's a tzaddik gomor? Say, well, maybe he did tshuva. Our question was, it's not enough. Doesn't one need to do vidui? How can he become a tzaddik? It's not so easy. He's missing pieces. Well, says the Kotzker Rebbe, there are certain people who have special assistance in terms of having their averus atoned for and removed. One of them is someone who gets married. Chosan, on the day of his wedding, he gets kapara, and therefore, here's the person, he chose the best day. because he says he's a tzaddik gomor if he thought tshuva, so the fact that he's getting married today helps him. So that's why the Kotzke Rebbe says the kiddushin are valid. What's very interesting is it's a stunning point, and yet it's not so simple. For those who are of yekish mind, it's not so simple, because when you think about it, it is true that when a person gets married, his sins are atoned for, but he's got to get married in order for his sins to be atoned. Here, the marriage is on condition that he's a tzaddik. So for him, he needs his sins atoned in order to get married. You can't take what you need for the marriage to work, assuming that will happen because the marriage works. That's called, impossible. And therefore, one needs to say more. There is a concept which is called bo'in ke'echad. The two things happen simultaneously, which is a classic Gemara concept. But that's easier said than done. But in any case, these are the responses to the very interesting question from the would-be bridegroom who claims that he is a tzaddik gomor, even though we know only to the contrary until that point. Okay. So having spoken a little bit about the mitzvah of vidui, which, as we mentioned, is based in this parsha, let's move to the section of the korbanos of the Nesiim. And that takes up essentially the second half of the parsha. The perek, I believe, is 89 psukim long. This is what makes Parshas Noso the longest parsha in the Torah. It's repeated for each and every nasi, and there's a classic comment of Ramban: why is it repeated? Everybody wants to know, why is it repeated? And the Medrash tells us that the reason why it's repeated is because although every nasi brought exactly the same korban to the detail, whether it's with the animals involved and etc. and so forth, but each one was for different reasons. The motivation behind it and the kavanah that accompanied it was different for each nasi, things that related to his shevet specifically, or whatever it may be, and therefore they are treated as separate korbanos, even though in external point of view, they are all identical. Ramban says something slightly different. Ramban says, al derech hapshat, a very beautiful thing, that all of the nasiim, in fact, had this idea that they wanted to bring these korbanos. Interestingly, it is with regards to this, the Medrash says, hiskima datam ledas hamokom. No one asked them to bring these korbanos, they intended to do so, and Hashem agreed that it was acceptable. So the initiative was theirs, and Hashem agreed. There was one difference. They all intended to bring their korbanos on the same day, on the first day. Why should they wait? Why would each Nasi say, I think I'll bring mine on the 10th day? They all intended to bring it on the first day. In that respect, HaKadosh Baruch Hu formatted the idea and rather said, no, Nasi Echad LaYom, Nasi Echad LaYom. They should not bring them all on the same day. Rather, each one should have their own day. That was something that they had not considered. But that being the case, says Ramban, each of these Nasiim wanted to bring something. It was L'Shem Shamayim. It was to honor the Mishkan. This is Chanukah HaMishkan. And therefore, because they wanted to honor the Mishkan and to honor Hashem, Hashem honors them. How does He honor them? He honors them by mentioning each and every Korban, each and every Nasi. That's the highest honor. As opposed to saying, well, whoever went first, now you know what they brought. The other 11 brought the same thing. Information would be complete. There would be no information missing. But what's missing is the cover that the Torah wishes to give to each of them for that gesture of wanting to bring these korbanos. That comes out by giving each of them the mention. They get their 5 or 6 psukim, and that's the way the Torah does it. And presumably the message is, and that's the way we should do it. Now, if we take a look at the korbanos, and we begin, I guess, with Nachshon, because the details are the same. They begin actually before we get to the animals of the korbanos. And for example, Perek Zion Pasuk Yud Gimel, there are two kalim that are filled with flour, with soles, which are brought for a mincha, for a meal offering. The korbano karas kesef achas. For the korban, there was a bowl of silver, shloshim mea mishkala, that weighed 130 shekels. In addition, there was Mizrak Echad Keset, there was another type of container, a bowl, also of silver, Shivim Shekel, but Shekel HaKodesh, which was 70 shekels in weight, Shnei Meleim Soles, they were all both filled with Soles for Mincha. Okay. So you have these two vessels. One of them, it weighs 130 shekels, one of them weighs 70 shekels, roughly half of the first one. Both of them have Soles in, and that's that. There's a very interesting concept, comment, which is made by the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. One of the Targumim that we have in addition to Targum Unkelus is known as the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel. And the Yonasan ben Uziel states, with regards to these vessels, that the walls of the first vessel were thick, and the walls of the second vessel were thin. And Mefarshim are wondering what's behind this comment, the thick walls and the thin walls, and how does the Targum Yonasan ben Uziel know, and what's the significance of this? And this question was addressed by the Vilna Gaon. It is said in the name of the Vilna Gaon that the background to all of this is a Gemara in Maseches Yoma, in Daf Samach Vav, which discusses the Shnei Seirim, the famous two goats of Yom HaKippurim, Sar Lashem, Sar Lazazel. And there are halachas about these two Seirim, specifically that they need to be as identical to each other as is meaningfully possible. That means that they have to be similar in size, similar in color, similar in value, really in as many ways as possible. So says the Mishnah in the sixth parak of Maseches Yoma. And the question is, why? Or how do we know this? I mean, we know that there's two of them. How do we know that they're the same? And the Gemara provides the background. The Torah says in Parshas Acharemos that Aaron should take Shnei Seirim. Shnei Seirei Izim. Two goats. Says Gemara, if you follow the Parsha, you will see that there's two of them. Because one is Lashem and one is Lazazel. If the Torah tells me that one is Lashem and one is Lazazel, I myself know that one plus one is two. Which means the Torah did not need to tell me that there's two of them. It didn't need to say Shnei Seirei Izim. And moreover, to be even more precise, any plural form, unless otherwise specified, is going to be two, because you have no license to say that it's more than two. Had the pasuk just said Seirim, we'd not be at liberty to assume that it's anything more than two. That being the case, the word Shnei is redundant. And because it's redundant, it tells us that Shnei means not only that there are two of them, but rather that they are identical. And this now becomes a concept that can be seen throughout the Chumash. It's true for other Korbanos as well. When it says Shnei, the Shtei Tziporim of Metzorah also need to be as identical as possible. And moreover, says the Vilna Gaon, this may help us address a question that was asked by the Ibn Ezra. There is a well-known Gemara in Maseches Chulin, going back to Maaseh Bereishis, with regards to the sun and the moon. The Gemara states that there seems to be something of a contradiction within the same pasuk about the creation of the sun and the moon. So on the one hand, the pasuk says, "Vayas Elokim eshneyam ha'uras hagedolim," that they are both gedolim, and then goes on to say, "Es ha'ma'or hagadol," which limim sheles bayom, is the sun, "Es ha'ma'or hakatan," limim sheles balayla, is the moon. So the Gemara says, well, how can you call them gadol and katan? What about the beginning of the pasuk, which says, "Shneyam ha'uras hagedolim"? And this is the basis, the background, for the well-known comment of the Gemara, that originally they were indeed of similar size. The moon complained, "Eifshal lishnei melachim lishdamish bekeser echad," and it lost its equal status with the sun. It got diminished, whatever that means, as we discussed on another occasion. But what's interesting is, says the Ibn Ezra, who's keeping a close eye on all of this, let's remember, how did this begin with the pasuk? Contradiction. It begins by saying they're both gedolim, and then goes on to say one's big and one's small. That's a contradiction. Well, says Ibn Ezra, I don't necessarily see that as being contradictory, because everything is relative. Relative to the stars, the sun and the moon are both gedolim. They're way bigger than anything else in our experience. But between them, one's bigger and one's smaller. So calling them both gedolim, and then between them one is gadol and one's katan, that can go side by side. That's not a contradiction. And therefore, says Ibn Ezra, I'm not entirely sure why the Gemara saw this as a contradiction. Says the Vilna Gaon, the point of the contradiction is not that they're originally both called gedolim and then gadol and katan. The point of the contradiction, as far as the Gemara is concerned, is because the pasuk says Vayas Elokim es shnei ha-me'oros ha-gedolim. It's like the shnei se'irim. We know there's two of them because you go on to talk about gadol and katan. So why did the pasuk say shnei ha-me'oros ha-gedolim? Shnei means shavim. Shavim is equal. If they're equal, how can one be big and one small? That's where the contradiction in the pasuk comes from. Not from gedolim, but from shnei. That's the classic response of the Vilna Gaon. And in Yaneinu, says the Gaon, we now may have a sense of what was behind the comment of the Targum Yonos ben Uziel. Again, the Targum Yonos ben Uziel stated that you have two kalim, and one of them weighs 130 shekel kesef, one of them weighs 70 shekel kesef. Okay, says the Targum Yonos, the walls of the first one were thick, and the walls of the second one were thin. I mean, where is that coming from? Says the Gaon, let's go back to Pasuk Yud Gimel. V'korbano karas kesef achas, so the first container is shloshim ha'me'a mishkala, 130 in weight. Mizrak achat kesef, the second vessel, is shivim shekel b'shekel ha'kodesh, 70 in weight. Shenehem meleim soles, both of them filled with soles. Says the Gaon, we know now that you've spoken about two things. You don't need to say that they are both. The pasuk could just say meleim ketores. Shenehem meleim means that they're identical. Except how can they be identical? One weighs almost twice as much as the other. How can one weigh so much more and they still be identical? Says the Gaon, that's why the Targum Yonos ben Uziel says they were identical in size. How so? Because the walls of the first one were thicker and the walls of the second one were thinner, and therefore even though there was less silver there, it was the same size because the thinner walls gave you a bigger kli. So this is the Vilna Gaon looking for every word to see the comments of Chazal, where they came from. We should note, it's important in terms of Parshanut, Rashi never mentions this idea that shnei means equal. If you look in Parsha Sacharemos, shnei se'ire izim, Rashi doesn't say that they're equal in no context. how can he not mention it? After all, is it not redundant? Well, al derech hapshat, no. And this brings us back to the difference really between derech hapshat and derech hadrash. Derech hapshat is a straightforward reading. Straightforward reading, from many points of view, is less demanding than a drash reading. If everything checks out on a straightforward level, then the Pshutah Mikra is satisfied. To say, Shneim Meleim, does that jar, pardon the expression, with regards to these Kalim? No, it's perfectly in order. And therefore, a flag doesn't go up, Al Derech Hapshat. It's only the drash, because the drash is so much more exacting. And as we've mentioned many times, the word doresh actually means to demand, to seek. It's seeking out resolutions of questions that aren't really questions al derech hapshat. It wants to make sure that absolutely everything is in place to the finest detail. Beyond the straightforward reading, the drash will see the word shnei as redundant. And therefore the Gemara, which represents the world of drash, the world of Medrash Halacha, will pick up on these things. Rashi, whose commentary on the Torah is Pshuta Shel Mikra, so that's something that is not an issue for him. The only thing is, if indeed it's true, and it is, that Rashi never makes anything out of the word shnei, it doesn't mean on a pshat level that they're the same, but isn't it true that Rashi in his Perush on Parshas Bereishis does quote that episode with the sun and the moon? Originally they were equal, and then the moon got diminished. Anyone who learns Rashi will see it there. So the question is, well, why would Rashi talk about this? I thought Rashi doesn't really make anything of the word shnei. Shnei ma'oros, as the Gaon said. But the answer is very clear for anyone who consults that section, that pasuk that Rashi is talking about in Bereishis, Perek Aleph, Look at the Dibur HaMaschil, the words of the Pasuk that Rashi is commenting on. He brings this comment from the Gemara about the sun and the moon equal and then becoming unequal, commenting on the words, Dibur HaMaschil, HaMa'oros HaGedolim. The words that denote this idea for Rashi are HaMa'oros HaGedolim. It's not coming from the word Shnei. Rashi doesn't pick up on the word Shnei, but he does see the words Gedolim as being in conflict with then saying Godel and Katan. In other words, unlike the Ibn Ezra, who did not see that as a problem, al derech hapshat, Rashi does see that as a problem, al derech hapshat. The perceived equation of the sun and the moon, it doesn't come from the word Shnei, it comes from the word Gedolim, unlike the Gon, and that's Rashi's position over there. Okay. Interestingly, as a prelude, one could say, to the korbanos of the Nesi'im, they also offer gifts, in a sense, to the Mishkan, and they are referred to in Pasuk Gimel. Let's have a look at Perek Zayin, Pasuk Gimel. Not only do they bring animals, they also vayaviu es korban lefnei Hashem, sheish eglos tzav, six wagons, tzav. Rashi says tzav means covered over. Ushnei sabakar, 12 cattle, agala al shnei hanesiim v'shor le'echad. Each wagon was shared by two nesiim. 12 is 12 nesiim. Between them, they brought an ox each, and each wagon was shared by two. Vayakrivu osam lifnei hamishkan. It's very interesting that these gifts are seemingly called a korban. Vayaviu es korbanan lifnei Hashem. We're not aware from this pasuk that they were offered as korbanos. I mean, they are there to carry the pertinences of the Mishkan, the parts of the Mishkan. However, says Ramban, the word korban can also have a broader sense. Korban means a donation to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Mishkan, which it was. I mean, they gave them over to the Mishkan. So it's a korban in the loose sense, not in the sacrificial sense, but in offering it to the Mishkan. It's a korban. Alternatively, Ramban suggests that it may be that they brought all of their korbanos in these wagons. In other words, sheish eglos means the six wagons worth or full of korbanos. They are the korban that are mentioned in Pasuk Gila. But be that as it may. Now, Rashi tells us something interesting. For if you have a look at Pasuk Dalet, and then Hey Vayidaber Hashem Vayomer Hashem El Moshe Lemor, this is Pasuk Dalet of Perek Zayin, Pasuk Hey Kach Meitam, take them from them. V'hayu La'avod Es Avodas Omer, they should be involved in the avoda. If Hashem says to Moshe, take these wagons and the oxen from them, apparently the indication is that Moshe himself was not prepared to receive them until he was told. Why does Moshe not wish to receive them? Well, the Sforno says, very simply, it's not a simple matter to receive these wagons and oxen to carry things in the Mishkan. After all, one could say that perhaps they should not be put on wagons. Perhaps they should be carried by people. That seems to be more derech kovod. As we find, ultimately, that the actual Kalim of the Mishkan were not put on wagons. They were in the jurisdiction of the B'nai Kehos, and they carried them personally. They carried them themselves. And the Sforno explains that Moshe, in a sense, was sensitive to the covet of the Mishkan, on Hashem's behalf, in the sense that maybe all the parts of the Mishkan, including the beams, and including the courtyard and the whole thing, should all be carried personally. There should be no wagons. Maybe that's a bit of a zilzal. And therefore Hashem said to him, no, it's acceptable, whereas the kalim themselves will be carried by kahas. Nonetheless, the beams and so on and so forth, they actually, it's acceptable for them to be put on the agolos, kach me'itam. That's okay. Another point which is interesting, which the Medrash points out, is that Moshe hadn't been told to receive them, but the Nesi'im are bringing them. Moshe actually had a bit of a chalisha sadas here, says the Medrash, because he felt that he was out of the loop. If indeed Hashem wants them to, did Hashem tell them to bring these things? Why are they bringing them? Hashem told them, but Hashem didn't tell Moshe. Somehow he'd been excluded. What's behind that? So Hashem said to him, "Lo tanuach da'atcha. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell you. I didn't tell them. This was their own initiative. But it's good. It's correct." Again, his schema datum ledas hamokum, and therefore nothing's gone amiss, and no one was excluded from anything. They had initiative, and it was sanctioned by Hashem. But there is perhaps another way of understanding why Moshe is a little bit reticent in receiving these agolos, these wagons. There are six wagons, Shesh Eglos Tzav, and the Medrash discusses the significance of the six wagons and connects the six wagons to the Shesh Yisimei Bereshis. Keneged Shesh Yisimei Bereshis. In a sense, what that means is putting these kelim on a wagon, which is a kind of a more normal or natural or mundane way of carrying anything. You put it on a wagon and it's drawn by the oxen. That really seems to be tending somewhat towards the way of operations of Shesh Yisimei Hamaaseh. And it's important to realize that this is in direct contrast with the kelim of the Mishkan, which really represented the antithesis of the natural world. Specifically, the Aron, which is carried by Bnei Kohath, the Aron doesn't weigh anything. And it's made of gold, doesn't weigh anything. In fact, not only does it not weigh anything, it doesn't weigh down on those that carry it. The Gemara famously says, Ha'aron no se es nosav, it carries those that carry it. Anyone who has the poles on their shoulder gets carried by the Aron. That's completely the reverse of any natural way of carrying. Not only is it not carried in the normal way, that is to put on a wagon, it's carried by them and it carries them. It is immune to any laws of nature. The Gemara further says in Maseches Bava Basra that the Aron Einam in Hamidah. It didn't take up any space in the Kodesh HaKodoshim. You could measure from one side and the other side. When you put the two together, that's the entire width of the Kodesh HaKodoshim. It's like it doesn't take up any space. It's completely excluded from any of the rules of nature. Not surprisingly, it represents a realm which does not subscribe to any of the rules of physical nature. So that's the Aron, and representing the Kelim. And now you have these other parts of the Mishkan, the beams and the sockets, which are quite heavy, and they're put on agolos, which is very natural, and there's six of them, which corresponds to the natural order of the world, Shesh Yisimei Hamaaseh. What is this combination? What is this duality almost? The kelim on the one hand do not answer to the rules of nature, and the other parts of the Mishkan actually correspond to the parameters of the natural world. Said the Sfasemes, what is being promoted here is essentially trying to find, in a sense, an interface between the Kedusha of the Mishkan and the natural world. As if to say, the more the aspects of the Mishkan, the elements and components of the Mishkan, are an entity unto themselves, not answering to the rules of physical nature, so in a sense, the less the natural world, one could say, is impacted by them, because never the twain shall meet. And therefore the bridge, so to speak, is to take some of the more external aspects of the Mishkan, and yes, to apply them to the parameters, to the metrics of the natural world. To take six agolos, and to put parts of the Mishkan on, because that in a way is creating a bridge whereby the Kedusha of the Mishkan can then filter into the natural world. If we come back to the word tzav, shesh eglos tzav, Rashi tells us from Chazal, it means covered over. And once again, that's representative of the natural world, whereby Hashem's will and his input into the world is covered over. But that's got to be reached, that's got to be impacted by the Mishkan, and that's done by having some of the component parts on these six agolos. In a sense, therefore, Moshe's hesitance to accept them is because he sees this as somehow lowering the Kedusha of the Mishkan, because they're now subject to the laws of the physical world. Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, the Nesi'im, in a sense, were more part of the physical world than Moshe, so they have this drive to have the Mishkan injected into that through these wagons. And Hashem says that in this instance, they're correct. Hiskima datum ledas hamokam. And perhaps one may say, for this idea, it's a rather lofty and perhaps abstract idea. Kedusha affecting the physical world, it's one of those things that's easier said than done. Perhaps it's for this reason that this sort of thing had to come from the initiative of the Nesi'im. Because if they don't put themselves forward, if they're not inspired to have this initiative, to have the Kedusha affect the natural world, then perhaps it won't. Because it's very easy for the opposite to happen. You mix Kedusha with the natural world, one can either elevate the other, or the other can bring the one down. And therefore, they showed themselves eligible for such a lofty idea by coming forward with the idea. What's called Isarusa de la Sata, right? There was an awakening from below on the part of the Nesi'im that made them qualified for it to be a good idea, as it was indeed sanctioned by Hashem. What's interesting to note is this concept of these six wagons representing, in a sense, Kedusha entering into the world of the Shishis Emei HaMaaseh. There was a precedent for this. It's a pre parallel, because when Yosef sends for Yaakov, and this is back in Parshas Bereishis, Chumash Bereishis, before there was a Mishkan, but he sends wagons for him, and the pasuk says Vayaras HaGolos, he saw the wagons, and the Zohar Kodesh comments that Yosef sent six wagons for Yaakov and makes the connection between those six wagons and the six wagons of the Nesi'im. And essentially, say the Mefarshim, Sfasemis, again largely, the idea is the same. Because Yaakov, it's not appropriate for him to go down to Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is a land of Tumah. He's in Eretz Yisrael. He's Kodosh. It's not a good fit. Except that's where the Jewish people are, and they need to be in Golos, and they need spiritual input in Golos. They need Yaakov in Golos. They need his input in order to see them through. From a certain point of view, therefore, Yaakov going down to Mitzrayim on these six wagons represents that spiritual input allowing his family to survive the Golos. If they don't have Yaakov with them, and what Yaakov represents with them, so then they'll be lost in the Golos. So it's very interesting to see this echo, or pre-echo really, of the idea of the Agolos of the Nesi'im, because it's the same idea in diametrically opposed contexts. With regards to the Chanukas HaMishkan, they offered these six Agolos, they donated them on the day the Mishkan was being set up, which represents Geula. It represents things as they should be, but this is how they should be, in optimum times. Yaakov is using the same idea to see them through Golos. But the concept is the same. They're only going to get through Golos if they have Yaakov. In that respect, those are the wagons which need to carry the message of Yaakov. So these are some very interesting aspects of the Golos of the Nesi'im as described in the beginning of Perek Zayin. I just wanted to devote a few moments to Chag HaShavuos, Habalin Latova, and begin by referring to a comment of the Tur with regards to Birkas HaTorah. And the Tur, as he presents the Halachas and the Brachos, and this is Orach Chaim, Simen Mem Zayin, he then describes what's Birkas HaTorah all about. He presents the Brach of Hashemar Chabanu, Mikol HaAmim, Nasananu Es Toroso. V'yichavin bibirkoso, says the Tur. When a person thinks Hashem chose us and He gave us the Torah, he should have in mind Mamad Har Sinai. He should remember, have in his thoughts Mamad Har Sinai. Hashem brach avonu mikol ha'amim. That's when Hashem chose us. V'kervonu lifnei Har Sinai, brought us to Har Sinai. V'yishmiyanu dvarav mitocha esh. He told us His words from within the fire. V'nosonanu es terosa hakadosha, gave us the Holy Torah. Shibeis chayenu, which is our life. Klichem doso, the jewel of his desire, Shahaya Mishtasheaba B'chol Yom, that Hashem delights in the Torah every day. That's based on a pasuk in Mishle, in the Perek Zayin or Ches, V'ayesh Shashuim Yom Yom, that the Torah says with regards to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the delight of Hashem. And Mefarshim are wondering, why is it important to be conscious of this? That the Torah is the delight of Hashem. And moreover, the idea clearly is that if Hashem delights in the Torah, well then so should you. And that's part of your orientation as you make Birchas HaTorah. Which means that a significant or a key element within learning Torah is to learn Torah in that shashuim way. If Hashem finds the Torah delightful, so to speak, then we should do the same. Why does it make a difference if a person finds the Torah delightful, if they are delighted by their Torah studies? Well, on a simple level, in a sense, it's kavod haTorah, it's respect for Torah, because the more enjoyable a person perceives the Torah to be, so that in a sense the more honor he's giving to the Torah, as opposed to something which is perhaps less enjoyable, but he's learning it anyway, that's not very respectful. So on its most basic level, it's kavod haTorah. But there's more to it than that. The Avnei Nezer of Sokachov, who was a son-in-law of the Kotzker Rebbe, discusses this in the introduction to his work on Hilchos Shabbos, which is known as Eglei Tal. And it's very interesting because he is, of course, one of the Rebbes. He is the founder of Sokachov Hasidus. And one can see, in a sense, he's addressing almost like a Hasidish way of looking at learning Torah, which he feels is incorrect. He doesn't call it a Hasidish way, but he does describe it. Eskor, as he's in his introduction now, Masha Shamati Ktsas Bnei Adam. I've heard some people, Toen Miderech HaSeichel, they've erred in terms of correct understanding, B'inyan Limud Torah Kadosha, with regards to learning the Torah. Ve'omru, they said as follows, Ki Halomeid, U'mechadesh Chidushim, if a person learns, he propounds Chidushim, Ve'sameach U'misanek B'limudo, and he enjoys learning, that's not a good thing, say these people. Einzel, why? Because he detracts from the level of Lishma. It's not Torah Lishma. Einzel limud Torah kolkach Lishma, kuma hayalomid bipshitus. As opposed to if he would just be learning on a very straightforward way, she'ein lo me'alimud shum tanug, that he wouldn't be enjoying his learning, the less he enjoys it, and the more he does it anyway, so the more l'shem shemaim it is. And l'shem shemaim is a great value in doing mitzvahs, which means the ideal way to learn Torah is to minimize your enjoyment of learning Torah. Rak l'shem mitzvah. Uve'emes, says the Eglei Tal, ze to'os meforsam, this is such an enormous error. The Adarabba, the opposite is true. Ki zehu ikur mitzvah Torah. This is the ikur of Torah, li yosas v'sameach u'misanig b'limudo, that a person should enjoy his learning. That's the ikur limud Torah. Why? Why? In other words, one could say that it's maybe a hidur. Why is it the ikur mitzvah? Says the Eglei Tal very simply. V'az divrei Torah nivla'im b'domo. Because that's when the words of Torah really become part of his system. That's when he really connects with them. What does a person connect? A person connects with something that he finds enjoyable. He doesn't connect with something that he finds of little interest to him. And once he enjoys Torah, so that makes him connected to Torah. In other words, the Eglei Tal is reminding us, on the contrary, the goal of learning Torah is not just information in the mind. It's to absorb the ideas of Torah. Absorbing an idea will come when you enjoy it. That's the ikkar way of learning Torah. And just one more line he quotes from the Zohar HaKadosh, a very interesting thing. The Zohar HaKadosh says, Bein Yetzer HaTov uBein Yetzer HaRa Eino Misgadlin Ela Mitoch Simcha. The Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer HaRa, each one grows by the thing that makes them happy. If the person wants his Yetzer Tov to grow, he should make his Yetzer Tov happy. He should do Yetzer Tov things that make him happy. Because other things that make the Yetzer Hara happy makes the Yetzer Hara stronger. And therefore, says Eglei Tal, if a person wishes to have as their goal in life that their Yetzer Tov should be of maximum strength, else. So make it happy. And that's through being happy in learning Torah. And it's interesting to note, number one, how this gives us an unbelievable synthesis. Because on the one hand, learning Torah demands a great deal of awe, of mora. When we were at Har Sinai, it was not a light atmosphere. Everyone thought they were going to die. And there was thunder and lightning, and it was a trauma. And that's also part of Mamad Har Sinai. And together with that, you have this enjoyment. Awe and enjoyment don't normally go together. One precludes normally the other. But here they do come together, because they're both ways of allowing the Torah to be absorbed into the person. When you are in awe of something, it has your attention. When you're enjoying something, it has your engagement. And when you have both of them, that's a perfect combination. It does not exist in almost every other place. And so we find an expression in the words of Chazal in a number of places when they talk about the high level of learning Torah. The words were joyous as when they came from Sinai. In a sense, the adjective which is most apt for the level of Sinai is smechim kinesinasam misinai. And this is something which I believe we need to be reminded of, to be reinforced, perhaps even reclaimed. Very often in the name of seriousness or sophistication, we forget about the joy of Torah, and the loss is ours. The Rosh Yeshiva of Ponovich, Reb Shmuel Rozovsky, whose biography was just recently published from Talmidim, and the Ponovich Rav chose Reb Shmuel Rozovsky to open the Ponovich Yeshiva at the age, I think, of 29. And he saw him, he is the Rosh Yeshiva that will rebuild the Ponovich Yeshiva. The Ponovich Rav himself did not take over he did not resume as the Rosh Yeshiva. He was building yeshivas everywhere. But he chose Reb Shmuel Rozovsky, and the Chazon Ish endorsed the choice. The Chazon Ish says he is the Rosh Yeshiva of the next generation. And someone asks, he's the biggest Talmud Chacham, is that why? And the Chazon Ish says, is he the biggest Talmud Chacham? He's a big Talmud Chacham. But the reason why he's the Rosh Yeshiva of the next generation is because he learns and teaches Torah with such excitement, he will raise Talmidim, and he will then raise Rosh Yeshivas. That's what a Rosh Yeshiva needs. And in fact, in the reminiscence of one of the Talmidim, he remembers, as he thinks back to those Shiurim, how he used to sit there with a smile pasted on his face, because it was just so delightful from beginning to end. And he just sat there smiling throughout the whole Shiur. And at a certain point, he felt that perhaps he was being disrespectful to the Rosh Yeshiva, because you sit there smiling like that, and the Rosh Yeshiva is saying a very in-depth Shiur. So he decided he's got to bring himself under control, and no more smiling in the Shiur. It's going to be serious. And so he tried it for a couple of days. After the second day, Shmuel Rozovsky, the Rosh Yeshiva, came up to him and asked him if he was sick. He said, I've noticed you're not smiling anymore. You're serious. Are you unwell? Is something wrong? Is everything okay? So he said, I did it out of respect for the Rosh Yeshiva. I didn't want the Rosh Yeshiva to think that I'm not taking things seriously. And Reb Shmuel says, that's the way to learn Torah. That's the way it should be. And indeed, unlike other mitzvahs, we, part of our brachos, we ask, we ask to be exposed to the enjoyment within Divrei Torah. And I believe this is the perfect way to enter into Chag HaShavuos. There's much thought about the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, which there is, the chiyuv of Talmud Torah, which there is, not to forget the joy of Talmud Torah, which doesn't detract from any of the above, only adds to all of the above. And as we say, v'nismach b'divrei Torasecha kihem chayenu, certainly dover b'ito, pertinent thoughts for the Chag of Shavuos. I wish you all a Chag Sameach. We'll leave it there.